Okay, so the question was about my comment of finding an intuitive rhythm between a directed awareness on the breath and a more open, choiceless awareness where we're simply resting in the knowing of whatever's arising. Generally, in the beginning, for people who are starting, to get stabilized somewhat on the breath is helpful, just because it's simple. You know, it's not confusing, we just give it a simple object, or it could be sound. Once we have some little stability and just understanding of the practice, and begin to notice the other objects of experience that arise that I mentioned, in, you know, the sensations and thoughts and emotions, there are different ways of being with this flow of experience. So one way would be to stay steady on a single object, whatever it may be. The middle way would be to be with the breath, but then to attend to anything else that becomes predominant, that calls the attention. So for example, we're with the breath or with sound, and then we feel a strong pain, you know, in the body someplace. So then the pain becomes the object, and we're really noticing that. And then we come back to the primary object of the breath or sound. The third way is not to have any primary object, of just to sit in an open awareness, and moment after moment, sound, thought, sensation, breath, you know, we're just attending moment after moment to whatever arises and passes. For those of you with, you know, a fair experience in practice, which I think are many of you, you can play with these three different ways and just see, you know, what it feels like to do each one of them. After some time, there does get to be an intuitive sense of just what seems appropriate at a particular time. For example, if the mind is getting lost in thought a lot, you know, where there's some story going through the mind and we're just really lost in it, so then it might be helpful to give a little more attention to a specific object. If we're feeling pretty mindful, pretty aware, then we might want to simply settle back and be in the knowing of whatever's arising. And so to begin to just play and trust that if as you're sitting back and, you know, you're open to whatever's arising, you start to get confused. Oh, you know, what's happening? What should I be paying attention to? So then you might come back to something simpler. If you're on just on the breath and you're feeling, you know, like you're struggling or striving or getting contracted or a little too tight, so that might be a time to open it up. A very good feedback, and one which we get a lot in meditation practice, is the feeling of struggling. Whenever you feel that, you know, you're sitting or you're walking or in life, just at any time, when there's a feeling of struggle, it means just one thing. It means something is happening that we're not accepting. Because if we were accepting it, we wouldn't be struggling. So that sense of struggle, which can come a lot in the meditation practice, you know, where it just is not flowing easily, instead of that being a problem, I actually take it as very useful information. Right? That struggle is saying, and a very good response to it would be to settle back, you know, figuratively in the mind, to settle back, open up, and ask the question, okay, what's happening now? What's going on that's calling my attention but that I'm not attending to? So just to give you a few examples, we might be sitting, feeling the breath, and it's just, we're struggling with it. We sit back, we ask the question, okay, what's happening? Oh, there's some discomfort in the body that I was ignoring. But the discomfort's pulling us, we're trying to be with the breath, so of course there's going to be a struggle. Or so then we just open to the discomfort. Or we might be sitting, you know, feeling the breath, struggling, sit back, ask the question, okay, what's happening now? And we might say, oh, there's been this train of thought that I hadn't noticed. Right? So the train of thought is pulling us, we're trying to be with the breath, struggle. As soon as we open, oh, thinking. We just open to the thought. We're back in a place of ease. So you want to have fun with this. You definitely want to have fun even when it's difficult, because the difficulties themselves are teaching us something about ourselves. And I guess just one more comment about that rhythm between directed awareness and choiceless awareness and open awareness. Sometimes within a sitting, you know, we move back and forth. Sometimes that rhythm can happen in the cycle of years. Sometimes we might spend years just on the breath, or years just on loving kindness, or years just on choiceless awareness. You know, so there's a lot of room for just our own exploration. Right, so with the three different methods that I just described, is there a particular benefit associated with each of them? I don't really see them as three different methods. I sort of see them as three facets of the same jewel of mindfulness. You know, because it's all cultivating mindfulness and awareness. And whether we do it this way, we do it this way, we do it this way, it's the mindfulness that's important. It's not the object of attention. You know, so I'm going to repeat this. This, if you let this in, will save you lifetimes of suffering. It's not the object that's important. It's not the experience we're having that's important. What's important is whether in any moment we're aware of what's arising and not grasping or not. That's what we're cultivating. We're not cultivating, and we're not practicing for a particular experience. We're practicing, hopefully, for freedom of mind. Right? And where is the freedom? The freedom is in non-grasping. So a little convoluted mantra. It's a little awkward English construction, but it doesn't matter to what you don't cling. Therefore, you don't have to wait for some special experience not to cling to. You might as well not cling now to whatever is arising. This is really important, and even though, you know, we kind of get it, we don't really get it. Because I know from myself and, you know, the thousands of people that I meet with, it's just so easy to fall into the pattern of wanting in our practice. We're wanting something, right? And we're wanting even good things. You know, we're wanting calm, we're wanting concentration, we're wanting peace, we're wanting this or that. And it's not that these things are not desirable, they are desirable. It's just that we often don't have the right strategy for achieving it. Because wanting is not the way to get there. The way to get there is by not wanting. This letting go of expectation drops us back into that place of peace, into that place of stillness. But this is very hard to get. You know, it really takes a lot of practice. So it's one of the reasons I was repeatedly suggesting relax the eyes, because in a funny way, a lot of our wanting somehow, I don't quite know how it works, but somehow it gets connected with what our eyes are doing, even when we're sitting with our eyes closed. You know, it's like awareness doesn't have to do with our eyes. You know, and so we could feel the breath or feel sensations in the body completely independent of the eyes, but somehow inwardly we're looking. You know, and that looking is a kind of tension and is a kind of wanting to see. Right? And so it's really to relax. And relaxing the eyes is a very big help in that, to consciously do that again and again, so that the awareness just settles back and works very effortlessly. And it's simply open to whatever is arising naturally. Oh, it's a good practice of this. And you could take some time. A good practice is with sound. Because when we're just listening, I think probably more than any other sense, it's reasonably easy to just settle back, not do anything. It's a non-doing awareness. Sound appears and we know. You know, we're not doing anything in order to hear. And so we get the sense, the experiential sense, of the nature of mind being awareness. So it's nothing we have to do, it's we have to stop doing. You know? So we settle back and sounds just come and the sounds are known effortlessly. Well, we can know the breath or any other object in the same effortless way we're knowing sound. You know, sounds appear, the breath appears, a sensation appears, a thought appears. Can we be resting in that effortless knowing? It takes practice just because we've been conditioned to do otherwise, but is this making sense?
Yeah. I heard that message hundreds of times about not grasping and not, you know, wanting, strong wanting some results, no results. But still, if you practice for 20 years and you're just as miserable as when you started, then what's the point?
Could you hear that? Okay. So the comment then, the comment and the question was, he's heard it how many times? Many times, a thousand, a million. Don't want, don't expect, you know, just settle back. But if you've been practicing 20 years and you're as miserable now as you were when you started, what's the point? I'm kind of interested to know what's kept you practicing.
What's kept me practicing is in the past I've had glimpses of joy. And people say, you're not supposed to want that joy. That is the only reason I'm practicing is I want joy.
How many moments would you say you've had?
Well, in the past I had it. It doesn't come. I mean, I don't know. In the past I've had, you know, joy and peace, and it has slipped out of my hands. And I practiced what I wanted.
I get that you understand that. I'm just curious. I would look to see, I'd really kind of look as honestly as you can, to look to see if, using your language, if you're getting something else beside the joy that's keeping you practicing. Because I'm just a little doubtful that you would practice for 20 years feeling you're not getting it and keep on doing it. Because after 20 years, you might think, this is not leading where I want to go. So my guess is that you actually are getting, again, using your language, getting something. It might not be your idea of what you want. It may be something entirely else, you know, which keeps you for 20 years practicing. So I think something's going on that you may, something positive, you know, in your life that actually is keeping you practicing. and that you're not in some way acknowledging because the mind is fixated on that particular experience. And it could be something like, this is just a possibility, I don't know what it is. You would really have to see for yourself. But it might be as simple and as profound that through practice, you're a little more awake and aware of what's arising than you would be if you weren't practicing. You know, and you may not experience that as a great joy, but it's actually more profound than joy. You know, it's the difference between being awake and being asleep, even if what you're awake to is how miserable you are. You know, because it's better to be awake to that than lost in it. That's not insignificant. So I think it's kind of, you really need to reframe, you know, the question you're asking. Because I don't think you would be doing it for this long if you really weren't experiencing something of value in it. Okay, again, so I guess the question was about, you know, the suggestion of not wanting experience, but still dropping back into stillness is an experience, and it's having that want seems to be a good thing and actually leads us to it. So let me clarify, because one of the problems is that words in English, we often use words that have different meaning, the same word that has different meanings, and that's why it can sometimes get confusing. So for example, the word wanting or desire, which often comes up in Buddhist teachings, you know, where it talks about how desire is the cause of suffering. Well, in Pali, you know, the language of the Buddhist texts, there's a very specific word, tanha, which is translated in English as desire, tanha being the cause of suffering. But in English, desire means many things. Desire can mean kind of a grasping mind, which does cause suffering. Desire can mean aspiration, where we have an aspiration for peace, an aspiration for awakening. We have a sense of direction that's of value in our lives. That's very different. It's a different mind state than the desire that's clinging and grasping. There's also, we could say, desire for food, for water, just the natural, you know, what's needed to sustain the body. And so when I use the wanting, you know, or desire, and it would have been better to clarify it in the beginning, it really is about the grasping at or expectation in the moment. That's what the problem is. It's not about not having the aspiration for peace or freedom or awakening.
Yeah, I just wanted to say one more thing, which is that I think that moment is a moving one, and that we actually want it, a static one, when we're looking for something that's not helpful. Because in that, pulling back that freedom, that moment is actually really alive.
You know, I would, so the further comment was about even what we aspire for, things of value, is not something static, that itself is an alive process. I had an experience early on, pretty early on in my practice, which was very useful to me, and I think points to this comment. I had been practicing in Bodh Gaya with my teacher Munindraji, and been practicing for some time, and I just had this experience doing walking meditation of sort of subject-object collapsing. You know, so there was just that experience of oneness, and it just felt wonderful. I was doing walking on the flat roof of this monastery where we're staying, and it was just in that collapse of two. You know, I was just kind of dancing around the roof. I was alone. Yeah, because it just felt so free. You know, so I go running to Manindra, you know, just telling him about this experience of just how free it was. And he just said one thing to me, which was so helpful. He said, don't recondition your mind. You know, because as your comment pointed to, already I was fixing freedom as being this. And it was such a useful feedback. Don't recondition, just be in this experience and let things unfold as they do. And of course, it changed and moved on to a lot of different understandings of what freedom can mean. Yeah. What's your experience? So the comment was that for many years he practiced a one-pointed concentration, more recently practicing a more open awareness of just being mindful of whatever is arising in the moment. And the question being... And what is your current experience of doing it this way?
Most of the time, I like it this way, but sometimes not.
Yeah. Well, as I suggested, I think it really is helpful not to get fixated on practice being a single way, because just at different times, the mind, it needs different kinds of balancing. Now, the whole process of awakening, there are many ways of describing that process. And different traditions will describe the process of awakening in different ways. But one way of describing it is a balance, is a cultivation and then balancing of the five spiritual faculties, which are faculties of forces in the mind, of faith or confidence, right, of energy, of mindfulness, of concentration and wisdom. So here's where the Buddha's teachings, this is just one example of the amazing clarity that the Buddha had in understanding the mind and what leads to suffering and what leads to freedom. I mean, just think of our own sittings. We sit, and maybe on a good day we put three or four breaths together. You know, the Buddha was able to look into the mind in just the way I described at the beginning, all of these forces at work in the mind, and powerful forces, and he was able first to distinguish them all, and then to see, oh yeah, these are the particular forces or mental factors or faculties, whatever word you like, these are the ones, when cultivated and in balance, lead to awakening. So just to see that, that's an amazing thing. So it's to understand that for using this particular template It's to understand that really the practice is a balancing act, you know, because at different times the concentration may be too strong and you need to raise the energy. Sometimes the energy is too strong and you need to strengthen the concentration. Sometimes the faith factor is too strong, you know, and we're just kind of coasting along on faith without the investigation of wisdom. And sometimes the wisdom factor is too strong. We're over-investigating and there's not enough trust in the process. You know, and so, as was said, the practice is not static and you need to see, you know, whether it's within a sitting or over days or for periods of time, okay, are the factors, do they seem to be in balance? Or is one or another getting out of balance and needs, you know, a corrective? In this regard, periodic feedback from a teacher can be really helpful, you know, because sometimes it's hard to see in ourselves, you know, exactly where the imbalance is. Okay, so the question refers to this one discourse of the Buddha, the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, and it's the basic, most fundamental teaching the Buddha gave about insight practice, about mindfulness practice. And he divided it, as most of you know, he divided it into four domains. Of mindfulness of the body, of feelings, whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, then what he called mindfulness of mind, and then the fourth foundation, which is difficult to translate, it's called mindfulness of Dhamma, it really means mindfulness of how different factors function. That is, whether they function as hindrances or they function as factors of enlightenment. You know, so there are many, many teachings within that fourth foundation. The third one, mindfulness of mind, is very interesting, and it points back to an earlier comment. Right in the discourse, it says, and one is mindful when the mind is concentrated, one is mindful when the mind is not concentrated. I love that. Because he's not saying just there, get concentrated. He's saying be mindful of how the mind is, right? And so it points again to the power of mindfulness not being dependent on a particular experience. We just want to notice, oh, the mind is like this now. It's concentrated. It's not concentrated. One aspect of this foundation, which I find, I don't know, fascinating and difficult and subtle and always a cause of interest for me. And the Buddha didn't use this language, so this is, it's like my interpretation of it. But I take it to mean mindfulness of moods. Now, moods, as opposed to strong emotions, you know, with strong emotions, because they're strong, we usually are, at least recognize that they're there, right? We may not be exactly mindful of them, but if there's strong anger or fear or joy, you know, they're apparent. But don't you have the experience often of just you going through the day and there's just some background mood that is so, it's just like there's a thin layer of something or a subtle filter through which we're looking at experience. And it might be, yeah, it might be calm. The mood might be calm. Or it might be maybe just a little impatience, or it might be a low-level worry, or it might be, you know, maybe a low-level happiness, or just something that's there that normally we don't notice. And because we don't notice particularly that it's there, it's very easy to become identified with it, you know. And so to turn the mindfulness to the awareness of these moods as a way of disidentifying, meaning not creating the sense of self, but just seeing, oh, the nature of calm is like this, the nature of fear is like this, the nature of, you know, whatever the mood is. I see that as all being the third foundation. This is a story, it relates somehow, I'm not sure how, but I think it has to do with interpretation of mood. I was on retreat, and I was doing walking meditation, and I was just feeling the weight of the world. You know, do you ever have that feeling where it just, you know, it just feels all the suffering that there is, and just having to care for the body, and just everything, just the weight of the world. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, this is really, I'm really getting the first noble truth here. You know, the truth of suffering. It's really like that. The Buddha really knew. And so I was in this kind of mood, and for about, I was walking 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And then all of a sudden, I burped. And the whole mood disappeared. And I felt light and at ease. And it was so funny to me that I had built up a whole story about an experience, completely misinterpreting, not that my thoughts were not true in a certain way, but it didn't have to do with the experience I was having, you know. And what was really striking was that a few days later, I had the same mood, I went through the same interpretation, and had the same burp. I hadn't connected it yet. So this just says something about being cautious about interpretation. Yeah, just let me, anybody on this side that, yeah. Could you hear that? Okay, the question was about a struggle with sound, especially unpleasant sound, in the meditation somewhat, but even more outside of the meditation.
More outside.
Yeah, okay, not particularly in the sitting.
I don't hear things with earplugs.
It's outside. Well... The first suggestion is to take the earplugs out, because the meditation then could be a training in a time and place when you actually have the space and the intentionality to work with your relationship to sound. So I would really do that because it's where I learned so many lessons just in that regard. At one time I was in India practicing, and in the summer months, very hot on the plains in Bodh Gaya. So we'd go up to the mountains, the hill stations, beautiful, you know, just the hill stations where you see the whole Himalayan range. So I rented this little cottage for the summer months, and there was a field just below the cottage. And I was doing a lot of intensive practice in those years. So I move in, and you know, it's great, and I'm just sitting. And then in the field below, one day this troop, they were called the Delhi Girls, and it was kind of a paramilitary Girl Scout thing. And they set up camp, and they set up these loudspeakers, and they were playing this loud Hindi film music, like from 6 in the morning till 10 or 11 at night. It's like all day long, this blaring of this loud, not to my ears, not very pleasant music. And I went through such a trip about this. I was angry and annoyed, and I was writing letters in my mind to the mayor, and how can you let this happen? And then I reminded myself, well, this is their country. So I was just, I went through a lot, you know, and it took weeks. And at a certain point, and it was amazing, just this whole process, at a certain point, my mind surrendered. Because there was nothing to do about it. You know, it was just there. But it took weeks for the mind to let go of the resistance to it, of the attempt, one way or another, to keep it out. And in the moment when finally the mind just let go and surrendered and let it in, just let it in rather than keeping it out, it was amazing. It completely ceased to be a problem. It was just sound. That's all it was. And it didn't interfere with my meditation. It wasn't a problem. I wasn't annoyed, irritated. But it took a process of letting go of that conditioning. And this points to another whole huge arena in practice. So it's basically the very deep conditioning we have to keep out what is unpleasant, whether it's sound or physical sensations or emotions or other people. You know, if we experience something as being unpleasant, the natural conditioned tendency, keep it out. That's the problem. It's not the unpleasantness that is the problem. The Buddha had a very radical statement about this, which every time I either say it or think of it, it kind of straightens my back. He said, as long as there's attachment to the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant, liberation is impossible. That's... there's no ambiguity there. And it also points, well, there's a little way to go here. You know, given our conditioning. So you actually want to welcome situations where we can practice this. That's why, whether it's in sitting meditation or walking or in life, at those times when we're confronted with what's unpleasant, that is a practice time. That is not a problem. It's right there we can see, is our mind open to this? Can we feel the unpleasantness? Or is there contraction? Is there pushing away? You know, and we see so many conditioned reactions to unpleasantness. It's all the many forms of aversion. You know, we don't like it, we hate it, we're annoyed by it, we're irritated by it, we're afraid of it. You know, so many different ways the mind pushes. Yeah. One little mantra. Let it in. Just remind yourself. Let it in. Let it in. Let it in. Let it in. And then you may have a moment of actually letting it in and seeing that there's no problem. That the problem is in the trying to keep it out. But you need to remind yourself, you know. And I really would not sit with earplugs, because then every time sound arises, it can be practice for you. And you can then take the practice, once you let it in, sound, it's a wonderful object, and one particular place of investigation, which we'll do just now. When I ring the bell, first try to let it in. Usually the bell people do let in. That's one sound that people are usually glad to hear. But now we're going to do another kind of little experiment. So when you hear the sound, just see if you can find what's knowing the sound. Okay, so that's your little experiment. And this is, stay very simple. I mean, you know, I'll hit the bell and the sound will appear. There's no, you don't have to do anything to hear it. The hearing is just going to happen. But can you find what's actually knowing the sound? Okay, the sound is being known. Known by what? So that should keep you busy for a while. I mean, it's interesting. It's just an interesting, you know, for me, it's a direct pointing to the nature of awareness, of consciousness. And the sound is being known effortlessly. It's just arising, and it's completely obvious. But known by what? What is it that's knowing the sound? You know, and you look for it, you look for what's knowing, and there's nothing to find. Did any of you find what's knowing? I mean, I'd love to know. You know, because when we look, there's nothing to find, and yet the knowing is happening. So what's that about? You know, it's really giving us a very direct experience of the nature of awareness. You know, and one of the qualities of its nature is its unfindability. And yet the knowing is happening. It's not that it's not there. I don't know. This is to hold as a question of investigation and interest, right? It's not so much to draw a conclusion. So sound can be so revealing in that way.
Could you say something about
working with strong emotional states?
Um,
I think it's multi-leveled. So the first aspect, I think, is just recognizing what it is, you know, and that's important, because if we don't recognize clearly what the emotion is, it's very difficult to actually come to an acceptance of it. And acceptance is a key step in the process. And I had an interesting experience of this once. I was feeling this strong emotion, and I was noting it. I was feeling it as sad, you know, it just felt really sad. But I was aware of it and noting it. But somehow, I kept on feeling caught by it, you know, really hooked. So I just looked more carefully. I said, okay, what is going on? Why am I hooked in this? And then I saw that it wasn't sadness. It was unhappiness. And they're close, but they're really different emotions. As long as I was misperceiving it, it was like looking at something but slightly off. And so as long as I was slightly off in my perception of it, I couldn't actually be there fully and accept it for what it was because of the misperceiving. So that's one aspect of recognition that, and for passing emotions, it doesn't really matter. But it's when we're feeling caught by something. So then it's worth really looking, if possible, and sometimes maybe we just won't recognize it for a while, but to really see if we can get a clear, oh, it's this. Then, second step is to explore its nature. It's as if, you know, we're a scientist with this emotion under the microscope and seeing, okay, what is anger like? Or what is joy like? Or what is fear like? You know, how does it manifest in the body? How does it manifest in the mind? The key element of this step is a quality of mind that is so powerful in freeing the mind, and that is the quality of interest. You know, when we're really examining and investigating the nature of the emotion, at that time we're not lost in the story of it. We're more interested in the nature of it. Right? And so with that interest, then our relationship to the emotion has already shifted. Right? We're no longer so caught, and there's that wisdom aspect. The third step and natural consequence of this whole process then is acceptance. You know, where we're just open to feeling it. Oh, this emotion is like this. It feels like this. And we're just experiencing it. Not caught so much in the story. Yeah. And then see that the emotion, like everything else, is passing. It's there for some time. And then it's not. And then maybe something will trigger it again. And then it's not. So that's one way of working with it. Another way. There are many ways. I did a retreat this was quite a while ago, it was about, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. It was the most difficult retreat of my entire meditative career. It was a self-retreat, it was in a beautiful place. With some friends, we had rented this house on Cape Cod, overlooking the ocean. It was beautiful. But during that retreat, the conditions came together, and I was having a lot of difficulty with my body at the time, and then did some things to try to help it, and it only made it worse. And basically, for about 6 weeks, I was studying anguish. That was the emotion. It was just anguish. It was so difficult. I couldn't even sit up. I was just like curled up. You know, it was powerful. It was just energetically and emotionally. But I also got very interested. What in the world is going on here? Because I had never experienced something quite like that before. Which is also to say you never know what's around the corner. So anyway, so I'm with this intense, intense emotion. But then I'm just watching and watching. And at a certain point I saw that there was one thought that was so incredibly seductive in terms of my believing it, that if I didn't catch that thought, I was gone. And maybe half an hour later or an hour later, I'd kind of stagger out from the story. And it was so believable to me, you know, that that's why I was getting caught again and again and again. So I just started, I set up a battery of radar, you know, inner radar. And so I was just watching, I was just waiting for that thought to come. And every time that thought, you know, and the key to this is having fun doing it. Because it's not, if you do it with aversion, it's not going to work. But when I could catch that thought, and like that, it didn't hook me. I didn't go down the path. I was freed of that whole emotional story. And I just saw in that particular situation the power of the connection between thought and emotion. You know, and how very often it's a single thought that will trigger a powerful tsunami of feeling. And yet it's all being conditioned by being identified with that thought. Right? So that's another way. I just, you know, just not get hooked.
And this can be like a sort of really
human life story. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I really believe this one. I mean, it was all about a negative me. And it was just so believable. This is not to say, even if we're using this technique, as opposed to the other one, which is a little more investigative of the emotion itself, you know, so depending on the situation and what it is, you want to use different approaches. But in both cases, it's not to say that the emotion, this is double negative, so you need to follow this. It's not to say that the emotion is not conveying some useful information. Because in many situations, emotions are telling us something, right? Useful. Maybe, you know, when people feel really kind of a righteous anger at injustice or a need to set a boundary, you know, where there's really an infringement of boundary and really need to. And often what gives us the information that something needs attending to is the emotion. So even as we're learning to work with emotion and not be drowning in them and not be identified with them, it doesn't mean ignoring what's useful, the useful information that may be contained in them. You know, and then we can respond to the situation in an appropriate way, rather than in a reactive way.
So what was your thought while you were shooting it down?
There was something, and it was, I mean, this is a rather personal question, but I don't mind answering.
You had some revisit with the opposite of the thought that you were shooting down.
Oh, you wanted to know the thought I had while I was, not the thought that I was shooting at.
No.
Basically, it was, I don't remember exactly because this was a long time ago, but it was basically the sense of gotcha. You know, it was more the sound effects than the thought. You know, it was. And it was just amazing how effective it was. You know, that I knew that I couldn't give it an inch. That it was just so easy to get pulled into it. Could you hear that? So the question was about a grandson. There's kind of abuse situation, and the reaction to when he's doing well, feeling happy in herself, when he's not doing well, feeling upset and sad about it, and often aware of this after. This is the part I guess I didn't quite get. So you're aware of these emotions after the fact?
I'm aware of my emotional
involvement.
Involvement.
Yeah.
And I worry so much about him that it'll keep me awake.
I mean, first, it's obviously a difficult situation.
Yeah.
You know, so it's understandable, kind of what you're experiencing. I think I would approach it from different sides. Maybe most fundamentally, it's about the development of equanimity, you know, and that equanimity is precisely the mind state which can hold pleasant and unpleasant whatever, you know. In this case, it's the personal situation of the grandchild, but it could be anything. It's equanimity, which is a mind state. It's a power of the mind. It's a factor of awakening. So it's a particular quality that can be cultivated, right? Which allows us to stay even, so to stay in equilibrium about whatever is arising, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. So one thing to do, I think, is to explore that particular meditation practice. You know, to understand that it is a quality that you can cultivate and strengthen. And so then it becomes a resource for you, you know, in this situation. And it's reflective of a teaching the Dalai Lama gave, which is hard. It's easy to say, not easy to do, but it's a practice to do, where somebody asked him about, you know, a situation, not exactly this one, but a similar. And he said, you know, if there's a situation and there's something you can do about it, there's no need to worry because you can do something about it. If it's a situation that there's nothing you can do about, there's also no need to worry because there's nothing you can do about it. You know? And that's that quality of equanimity. It's bringing wisdom into the emotional mix. You know, so these emotions, and as I say, it's quite natural that you would feel the way you do, but can you bring wisdom into the experience of them rather than simply be drowning in the emotional reactivity? You know, and so That's one practice. The story I just told could also be of help because it's probably a thought that triggers the whole story. You know, and if you're missing that first thought, you'll be awake all night. Yeah. And so to really train the mind in alertness for what the trigger point is for the emotion. Right? Because the emotion is arising out of certain conditions. There's a condition for its arising. Can you really see and pinpoint what that condition is so that you're not lost in it? I mean, it's exactly the story of the anguish. And the third thing I would do, and again, it's kind of reiterating what I just said, it's training yourself to be mindful closer to the arising of the emotion. If you miss the trigger point and you're not done, the equanimity is not quite strong enough yet, right? So the emotion is there, you're feeling upset, you're feeling worried, you're feeling anxious. Or the other side, when you're feeling happy that he's doing well, can you bring the mindfulness back closer to the arising of those emotions so that as the emotions do arise, you actually are mindful of them? Oh, this is the anxiety, this is the worry, this is the joy. And then you explore it in just the way I mentioned, really investigating its nature, seeing your relationship to it. So it's workable. But you need to step out of
the drama.
Yes, the seduction of the drama. You know, and it's hard because it's a real life situation and somebody you love and care about. So it's to recognize that it's difficult, but this is what awakening is about. You know, it's not when the Buddha talked about enlightenment. He wasn't talking about simply being in a good mood. You know, that's not what this is about. It's about right in the heart of suffering, right in the heart of it, where's the freedom? You know, because if freedom is dependent on conditions, it's not freedom. You know, if we have to have everything just so, whether it's in our body or in our lives, to be free, it's not freedom. And so that's why, both for myself, and I've seen it with so many people, sometimes in our lives it's the situations of the most intense suffering when we have the capacity and the interest to investigate become the source of huge understanding. I'll tell you another story just in this regard. This also happened years ago, fortunately. things get lighter the more one practices, but you know, we need to go through a lot. So years ago, a close friend did something which I just felt as a complete betrayal of trust. You know, and I had never experienced betrayal before. I mean, it was just, you know, it's something you read about in novels. And it was just so painful. It just felt like a knife in my heart. You know, because this was a friend. So I really went through a lot. But again, I really have this strong interest in understanding suffering when I'm going through it. What's going on? You know, how am I getting caught by this? And so, and this took many, many days, you know, feeling it and looking at it. But at a certain point, as I was investigating, I saw that for that knife to hurt, it needed a place to land. And when I saw or reconnected with the basic selfless nature of experience, that was like removing the landing place. So then the knife went in and it went out and there was no one there to be hurt by it. And so when I got to that place again, oh yeah, you know, that it was my own clutching at the knife that was cutting me. You know, it was amazing, it was so freeing, and it completely removed any feeling of ill will towards this person. And now, we're quite good friends, I don't trust him completely. But that's okay, that's just like understand, okay, this person, you know, just like we have our, you know, we will have our own shadow side. So it's really remarkable to see that the freedom depends on us. It doesn't depend on what another person is doing or not doing. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
It's the goal of liberation.
Yes.
What is, you know, all, what we have power to, that's what I want to do. It's like really nice.
It's very, I mean, the Buddha, when he was asked, the question was about what is our aspiration in practice? What are we practicing for? The Buddha, he put it very simply. He said, he teaches just one thing, suffering and its end. You know, it's not complicated. It's not easy, but it's not complicated. So the question, going back to the earlier question about the grandson, what to do about or with the compassion or empathy, you know, for the child. The compassion itself is a very wholesome state, and I think it often naturally arises, and this is really interesting. I mean, it's the great thing about the Dharma is any one point, you can enter it any place, and then it just opens to everything. You know, so when does compassion arise? The cause for compassion to arise is a willingness to open to suffering, to pain. This is not always so easy to do. You know, it's like we may think, and often we are really compassionate, but very often it's hard to let the pain of someone else in, or our own, you know, to really open to it. And so there are a lot of defenses that we have, conditioned defenses for not letting it in. Sometimes those defenses are exactly the reactive emotions. You know, we have this emotional reaction that doesn't allow us to fully experience the pain of the other person. But when we do, when we can open in that way, right, the response of that openness is the feeling of compassion. And compassion the expression of compassion really is contained in the thought, whether expressed in the mind or not, but it's really contained in the thought, how can I help? You know, in a situation of suffering, how can I help? You know, and that's what moves us to act. It needs to be balanced with equanimity, because sometimes we can help and sometimes we can't. Sometimes there's nothing we can do. So that is the balance, you know, of those two factors. Just a little sidebar to all this, and quite a subtlety. you know, each of these states of loving kindness and compassion, joy and equanimity, each one of them has, as many of you know, something called its near enemy, something which looks like it but is not it. So the near enemy of compassion is sorrow. And they can be very close, but they're very different mind states. Because sorrow is, what's the word? What's the opposite of uplifting? Downlifting, downgoing. You know, sorrow, we sink into sorrow. Whereas compassion, when we're really feeling compassion, and this is what's so, in a way it's paradoxical, because compassion comes from the opening to suffering, but the feeling of compassion is uplifting. You know? And so it's very interesting to watch in ourselves and to begin to discern the difference between those two feelings, because they're often confused. And in sorrow, and this is where the subtlety is, in sorrow there's an admixture of aversion to the suffering. In compassion, it's how can I help? Do you see the difference? It's very subtle, but it's a different flavor, it's a different perspective. One is the aversion to the suffering, which is often a natural response, but it's not a productive one. Or this suffering, and we're open to it, how can I help? It really opens our heart, and it's very energizing. So why don't we take a little break? It's 4:10. Why don't we take maybe a 15-minute break? Bathroom, I think there's some tea there. For those of you who would like to kind of keep the meditative quality, you could use this time for some walking meditation outside. Yeah, just, but as you like.